You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump has rolled out his budget proposals for the next fiscal year. We'll talk about what it invests in, what it would cut, and how it's being received in Congress. Now, about 4 out of 10 babies are born to unwed parents currently in the United States. If the parents are younger than 25, though, that number goes up to about 8 out of 10. While marriage once played a bigger role in tying young fathers to their families, many young people are choosing to delay marriage or not get married at all. Our guest and his co-author looked at the role these young fathers play in the lives of their children, in part by talking to them in a series of extensive interviews. Paul Florsheim is a professor in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee, where he continues to work with young fathers and their families. He's been looking at how society can better involve fathers with their partners and children. He's the co-author of the new book, Lost and Found, Young Fathers in the Age of Unwed Parenthood. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, back in the 90s, you were starting this research that the number of young pregnant teens and single moms was higher. It's gone down since then, but still a big issue. What made you decide to take a closer look at the fathers in this equation?
You know, it did start in the 90s. It was about 25 years ago, and the issue became apparent to me when I was doing research as a graduate student and clinical work as a graduate student. I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and just seeing a lot of families working both in research context and in clinical settings where the father wasn't involved, and I got curious about, you know, the dynamic was very different in families where fathers were involved and weren't involved, and I got very curious about what had happened to these fathers, and then decided over time that the best way to dig into that issue would be to try to catch them, you know, before the baby was born, when the fathers were still expectant fathers.
We've, as a society, I think, talked a lot about these young fathers, talk about absent fathers, deadbeat dads, things like that. You, and this is key to your book here, it's the heart of your book, you and your co-author talked to these young fathers. What kind of things did you start discovering when you were talking to them directly?
Well, let me back up a little bit. I mean, one of the things that we discovered pretty quickly is that it's not so easy to find young expectant fathers or young fathers at all, because they don't congregate anywhere. They don't receive services, and particularly in the 90s, they weren't receiving services. And so we sort of struck upon this idea of recruiting these young men through their partners, through the pregnant women, through prenatal clinics. And there were a few things that we discovered kind of right away. One was that we interviewed the young women as well as the young men, although we did it separately. We'd separated them into different rooms. And we learned a lot about these young men from their partners that wasn't necessarily coming directly from them. We learned that, you know, sometimes, you know, they told us things that the fathers didn't want us, you know, didn't necessarily want us to know. But a lot of times they told us about sort of the more tender aspects of these young men, how they took care of them while they were, you know, not feeling well, or how they supported them. And we were really struck by that this was – that the becoming of a father really – occurs within the context of the relationship with their partners, and we hadn't gone into this sort of looking for that, but that really was apparent. The other thing that we learned really early on is that at this stage of the game, when they were still expectant, these fathers were very hopeful about the future. They were scared. But they were also optimistic, and they were very open to having that conversation. And they all, and you know, almost a universal quality was that they wanted to be good fathers. They weren't sure they could get there, but they wanted to be good fathers. I think the third thing that we really were struck by was that you know, some of these fathers who looked like they were headed in a bad direction, you know, that they had a lot of risk factors that they were carrying with them, you know, trouble with the law, getting kicked out of school, having a hard time finding a job, substance abuse. We would sometimes have this response like, oh my gosh, how is this? This is not going well. This is not going to go well. And then we'd follow them over time. And a couple of years later, we were really surprised by how they had turned themselves around. So the other thing that really struck us was how these fathers were able to transform their lives through their connection with their child and with their partners.
Were there lessons that you saw? And I know you conclude with the book with recommendations, but from those guys who had that aha moment and turned things around, maybe unexpectedly, was there some magic ingredient? Was there something that we can learn from them?
Yes, I mean that's really as we started to do this work, I was interested in doing. I'm a clinical psychologist, so I was interested in doing interventions and developing interventions, but I really didn't have a clue as to what that would look like 25 years ago. And these fathers, who we call the better than expected fathers, gave us a number of clues. And one of the things that that we noted in them is that they might be really concerned about their ability to be a father and to connect with their child, but those fathers who had the support in place to sort of confront those challenges and to help them seemed to do better. And part of that support, and in fact, you know, several other researchers have sort of borne this out, that the most important part of that support for the young father is the partner. The quality of that relationship matters probably more than anything else.
Talking to Paul Florsheim from UW-Milwaukee, co-author of the new book Lost and Found, Young Fathers in the Age of Unwed Parenthood. And I remember distantly, Paul, it seemed like for a while, society-wide, the conversation was either there's a married couple or there's a single mom without the involvement so much of a dad. Clearly, there's a lot more to the story there. Can you talk about the importance of the involvement of that second parent, the dad in this case, even if marriage itself isn't involved?
Yeah, I mean, as you noted at the beginning of this segment, you know, a lot of young parents are choosing to not get married or delay marriage, and a lot of young couples who do get married end up getting divorced. And so, one of the things that's really happened over the last 50, 60 years is that, you know, sort of how we define the family is very different. The architecture of those relationships, you know, just looks different than it did 50, 60 years ago. But what one of the things that remains the same is that the role of the father continues to be important. So families where the father is involved, whether he's married or not, whether they're in a relationship or not, whether they're cohabiting or not, is an important determinant of how how secure that child feels, how emotionally connected that child is able to feel to others, and so how well they do in school. So it's basically, you know, a very simple, in some ways, a very simple principle is that it's easier to raise a children with two parents rather than one.
We're talking to Paul Florsheim, professor in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. He's been looking at how society can better involve fathers with their partners and children, even if there's not a marriage involved. He's the co-author of the new book, Lost and Found, Young Fathers in the Age of Unwed Parenthood. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this or was this your story? A young parent in a couple that isn't together, but maybe both parents involved in child raising. What helped you? What challenges did you face if you're a father? Is there something that could have helped you feel more connected and involved in parenting and in your child's life? Do you think our expectations for fathers need to change or even have changed over the last couple of decades? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Paul Florsheim, professor at the School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. He's co-author of the book Lost and Found, Young Fathers in the Age of Unwed Parenthood. Paul will be talking about his book at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee this Thursday, at 7 p.m. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a father, did you have any difficulty feeling connected or finding your role as a co-parent? If you had kids in an unmarried couple, were both of you able to work together to raise the kid? What helped you do that? What were some of the obstacles? And if you have questions for our guest, call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Dave is with us in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. As always, excellent show. And this call is going to be unironic, which is a stretch for me, but I will say this. We have a society which has made, yes, drastic changes in 60 years, which, as opposed to the at least 100,000 years of modern human development, should be unsettling at best, catastrophic at worst, and yet we seem to take this all in stride. What I would ask of our expert today, to what extent are the policies we put in place, which in many ways do not encourage a woman with a young woman or a woman who maybe has lower socioeconomic status, to stay with or encourage the relationship with the father, meaning for purposes of qualifying for Section 8, for purposes of qualifying for Quest Card, for purposes of qualifying for any income assistance, for purposes of getting an earned income credit.
I gotcha, Dave. And this is something you tackle in the book, Paul. Are there, a long-running question, are there incentives in public support systems that discourage couples from staying together?
There are, I mean, I think that this has been a long-running debate as to whether we are, I mean, it goes back to the 60s and the 70s where there was concern that welfare sort of supporting single moms would get in the way of fathers staying involved. And the research has not borne that out. One of the things that, you know, some of the policies or at least the practices that were put into place is that there were efforts to encourage couples to get married. And that really didn't work particularly well. I mean, there have been about 20 years of different efforts made in that regard. And so from my perspective, I think that for a variety of reasons – marriage just is less attractive for many of these young couples, and it does require us to think about what can we do as an institutionally to support these young families regardless of whether they decide to marry or not. One of the things we do work with young couples. We haven't brought this up yet, Rob, but we do have a program where we work with expecting couples to try to help them develop communication skills so that they're able to stay – so the fathers are able to stay connected with their child regardless of what happens to that relationship. And we're very neutral on the issue of marriage. We say it's up to you, you know, whether or not you stay together. We think these skills will be helpful to you in staying connected to your children.
Thanks for that call, Dave, at 800-642-1234. Paul, you also have a recommendation that there needs to be more of that sort of thing, including, in effect, bringing those expectant dads into the prenatal care picture, which is something we don't really do much or maybe at all. I don't know. What would that look like?
Yeah, so this book does have kind of a punchline to it. I mean, we do believe that one of the things that we could try to do, and this hasn't been done in any kind of systematic way, is to do what we call father-inclusive prenatal care, which would look like the expectation that fathers come in with their partners, whether they're married or not, and be assessed for what kinds of supports they might need to help ready themselves for parenthood, the challenges of parenthood. And I think it would require, you know, a rethinking of what prenatal care is. But we do believe that, and again, based on the experiences that we had with these expectant fathers, that the prenatal period is really the time to catch young men. They're more receptive. Their lives are less complicated. And it's a window of opportunity for helping them build the skills that they need to to function well as fathers and as partners. I mean, the partnership is critically important.
Paul Florsheim is with us from UW-Milwaukee, co-author of the new book Lost and Found, Young Fathers in the Age of Unwed Parenthood. In the conversations, Paul, you have with these young men, a very common theme has to do with jobs and economics, the concern that money going into raising a kid is money that they couldn't spend on, say, education or job skills, and that dividing up the role of trying to bring income into the child raising versus the time they could spend with the kid. Could you talk about some of the things you heard from those young dads?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that does come across pretty clearly is that fathers do still, these young men do still see themselves as the provider, as wanting to be the provider. And when they're not as successful in that role as they want to be, there is a great deal of shame. And that can be very difficult for these young men. And so if you were to ask young fathers what they need, what we provide, relationship skill building and counseling along those lines, they don't identify that as their primary need. What they would say is they want help getting a good job or getting a better job. One of the things that we try to convey in this book is that the role of men and families, of fathers, we believe needs to be more broadly defined, partly in keeping with the fact that the family has changed so dramatically, that women's roles are changing and men's roles need to change along with them. And not all fathers are necessarily going to be the primary provider, and they need help sometimes being able to see how they can contribute to child rearing other than just being sort of this the narrowly defined provider.
That speaks to another common theme that you ran across with these young men. They're very concerned with being a good father and trying to figure out what that means, sometimes with a very bad role model in their own fathers in some of the cases of the people you talk to. Can you talk about how they talked about what it meant to be a good dad?
Yeah, I mean, as I indicated, I mean, I think many of them, at least in the beginning, do define that role in terms of being, getting a good job, getting a better job, and being able to support that child, which, of course, is still very important. As time goes by and the child is born and they're taking care of the child, the father's – it's the connection with the child that really sort of does help solidify that sense of oneself as a father. And so many of them talked about being a good father just in terms of spending time with their child, waking up and seeing their child, diapering their child, being able to soothe their child. And there's tremendous sort of a sense of pride and accomplishment just in those simple things. And so for many of these young men, being a good father is just being connected with their children.
One of the things that struck me as you share a lot of the conversations in the book, I might have assumed that a lot of young men would be reluctant to talk about all these issues. And some of them, it seems some of them were, but it seems like there's really a desire to tell their stories and do their thinking out loud with a non-judgmental ear.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that struck us in the beginning of this work is that we did... as I said, we relied on pregnant women to kind of bring their partners in, sometimes drag their partners in, because most young men are not particularly interested in sitting down and talking to a researcher, particularly a clinical psychologist. And so it really was – we designed the process so that we asked these questions around their experiences of their relationships and their expectations of fatherhood in a way that was truly open-ended, that allowed them to tell the story. We conveyed really clearly we wanted the long story. There was no right answer. And once we were able to sort of help them see that this wasn't a test, that we weren't judging them, they got curious about the questions we were asking. Many of these questions, simple questions like, how are you feeling about becoming a father, were things that they had not been asked before and they may not have articulated for themselves yet. And that made the experience very interesting for us, but it also really made the experience interesting for them.
I want to bring on another caller. Skyler is calling in from Kentucky. Skyler, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, I think it would be really important for me to mention, first off, that I have twins. Give me one second.
Sure.
Yeah, I have twins, and I'm 18 years old. I found out my girlfriend was pregnant in high school. And I think the hardest part about being a father, especially of twins at this young, is the whole working aspect. So I work a really, really, I would say, demanding job. I work 12-hour shifts on a consistent basis. Mm. And coming home after 12 hours and not being with them that much is really, really hard. I feel like I don't get a lot of times with my son.
And Skyler, thank you for sharing that. We're just about out of time. Thanks for calling in as a fellow dad of twins. This work-parenting balance, Paul, was a consistent theme for many of the young guys you talked to.
Yes, it was. I mean, that the experience of Skyler is an experience that we heard a lot, and that's such a challenge because many of these young fathers are just working long hours, sometimes working 2-3 jobs, and it is a struggle because they want more time with their children, and but at the same time they're just working to try to support a young family, and that is sort of a quintessential challenge. And one of the things that that we try to convey, I mean, people might say, well, why would I want to read a book about young fathers? And there's so much in their stories that I think is sort of this universal struggle to connect and stay connected with children that I think many fathers feel, but also, even if you have a father, if you're not a father but you have a father, sort of that issue of father staying connected is kind of a universal theme.
Skyler, thanks for the call. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That is Paul Florsheim. His new book is Lost and Found, Young Fathers in the Age of Unwed Parenthood. Catch him Thursday at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Keeley Boltina continues a series of interviews with candidates in Wisconsin's Supreme Court primary election. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the White House has released President Trump's proposed budget for the 2021 fiscal year. It calls for $4.8 trillion in spending next year, boosting investment in areas like defense and border security. It also outlines a planned savings of more than $4 trillion over the next decade, in part by making cuts to Medicaid, the Environmental Protection Agency, and foreign aid. The White House predicts an annual federal spending deficit would continue for the next 15 years. Roy Myers is here to help us take a closer look at the plan. He's a professor of political science and affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He also worked in the Congressional Budget Office from 1981 until 1990 and is the author of The Handbook of Government Budgeting. Roy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Good to talk to you again.
Before we look into the details here, let's talk about this document itself. On one hand, it's probably not going to get passed by Congress. On the other hand, people say it's an important symbol of presidential priorities. How seriously do we take something like this?
Well, the agencies that helped put it together put a lot of weight on it in that they're going to have to go to their appropriations committees, at least for their discretionary budget, and ask for an appropriation for next year. And since the president has a veto, his position on those kind of appropriations levels are really important. And it's going to be up to Congress and the president to find agreement, one would hope, sooner rather than later on those issues. For a number of the mandatory spending proposals, which would require Congress to pass new laws, I think it's fair to say that most of what the president has proposed will be disregarded, especially in the House, because that's controlled by Democrats.
The House and Senator Mike Enzi, a Republican who chairs the Budget Committee, says he's not going to hold a hearing even on the budget, saying Congress simply doesn't pay attention to the president's budget, no matter who's in office. So is that about right when it comes to where we are today on this presidential budget in Congress?
Yes, and I think that's unfortunate. Not that I'm at all endorsing what President Trump has suggested in his budget, but it is the job of Congress to prepare a budget. It took on that responsibility under the Congressional Budget Act. And unfortunately, both the House and Senate in recent years have neglected to fulfill that responsibility. In part, they've decided not to put together a comprehensive budget because they've reached these two-year deals with both President Trump and prior to that, President Obama, on discretionary spending levels, adjusting the caps that had been put in place in the 2001 Budget Control Act. So since they've reached that kind of agreement, and since it's so difficult to get agreement across the aisle these days, given the partisan polarization we have, they basically have decided not to do their own budget work. So, in one sense, actually, the executive branch is a little more functional than the congressional branch is right now.
Yeah, in effect, it seems like we've had this series of deadlines and debt ceiling increases and stopgap spending bills. It seems like a strange way to run a budget.
Oh, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible, no question. I don't think there's any good reason for doing it. One of the motivations for this process, though, was the concern by people who have been very concerned about high deficits that inaction would be dangerous. So they set in motion these artificial triggers and deadlines where if Congress wouldn't take action, then bad things would happen, like, for example, the shutdown that has occurred a couple times in the last decade. It would be much better, of course, if both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, and both Congress and the president would agree to do their job and negotiate seriously, looking at accurate numbers and try and reach compromises here and there.
We're looking at the White House budget proposal that just came out. Roy Myers is with us from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. You mentioned the deficit and the overall debt, Roy. Looking at this budget proposal from the president, what do you see when it comes to their projections of when the annual deficit might go away?
Well, first of all, their projections are based on overly optimistic assumptions about the rate of growth of the economy and about interest rates. The estimate of growth over the next decade from the Trump administration is about 3% a year. And if you look on the other hand at the Congressional Budget Office's estimates, which are much closer to what the average private sector forecaster says, they're saying that growth would be 2.2 to 1.7% a year. And that's based in part by the demographics of this country. As we are aging, there are fewer people in the workforce, and in particular, if we have lower immigration, there'll be even fewer people in the workforce. And so the Trump administration's assumption that the economy will grow so strongly, which of course boosts revenues and reduces spending, but that also in that case that interest rates would stay at the remarkably low level they've been at in recent years, that just doesn't add up. So I think it's, you know, and by the way, this is not the first time that a president has used rosy assumptions to make a budget forecast look better. But it's somewhat more problematic now because our deficits are so large. I mean, we have $1 trillion deficits as far as the eye can see. If you look at the Congressional Budget Office's projections of deficits over the next 10 years, they would average $1.3 trillion a year if there are no policy changes. And that adds up. At some point, that's not going to be affordable, and we're going to have to make some really serious changes in our policies.
Now, looking at budgets past and present, it's not as unusual to run a really big deficit when the economy is doing really badly, like in the first few years after the Great Recession. But this is not that. This is after some years of sustained, decent growth. What's going on that's leading these big annual deficits, even though the economy's decent?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, if you looked at the deficit that was run during the Great Recession, was far too small. We could have cut taxes more and especially spent more and gotten the economy on the ball much faster. Right now, if you look at the combination of federal, state, and local government policies, they're actually stimulative. They are causing the economy to run at a rate that is faster than it can sustain over the long term. That's called potential GDP. And a lot of that comes from the federal government tax cuts that were put in place in 2017, and then the spending increases that were pretty large last year. Political scientists used to talk about something called the political business cycle, and the argument was that politicians, particularly presidents, try to make the economy as strong as possible in the year they're running for re-election. And I have to say there's an aspect of that right now.
Let's look at some of the spending details. Social safety net programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are a big part of any budget talks. Here's President Trump talking about some of those issues in his State of the Union address last week.
And we will always protect your Medicare, and we will always protect your Social Security, always.
What does the budget proposal do with those programs?
It doesn't touch Social Security, except there's some programs, proposals that I don't fully understand yet, having to deal with the Supplemental Security Income Program and disability insurance. But most of the cuts that are in that area are in the Medicare area, and almost all of those are reductions in the payments made to providers, to doctors, to hospitals, and to manufacturers and retailers of what's called durable medical equipment. So I would, and in addition, there's a fair amount of so-called fraud, waste, and abuse reduction in the budget. I hope that that would actually be carried out. It's often a difficult thing to do. The big difference, however, in the health care area is that the president goes after Medicaid big time, and that he is proposing some flexibility for the states, which has actually been proposed already in a rule that's been drafted by Health and Human Services that would allow the withdrawal of some services and the reduction of eligibility of the program for people who were brought into it under the Affordable Care Act. That's a very controversial rule, in particular because it would allow states who wanted to require what they call community engagement, which is a euphemism for requiring work or reporting that you've worked to be eligible for Medicaid. And so that's going to be a huge fight because it's unclear whether the statute that created Medicaid would, in fact, allow that requirement to be put in place. The one other thing I say about health care is that there's actually an opportunity for a deal between the Democrats and the Republicans in the sense of reducing payments for prescription drugs in the Medicare program. You know, there are bills in the House and the Senate. The president's numbers are very close to the Senate's numbers, and the real political question here is whether the Democrats and Republicans want to compromise on that issue this year and claim credit for it jointly, or would they want to disagree about it and run on it during the election.
Talking to Roy Myers, professor of political science and public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, looking at President Trump's proposed budget for the next fiscal year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What areas do you think the government should spend less on or more on? What about tax policy? Is the federal deficit and overall debt something that concerns you? What do you think of what you've heard of President Trump's proposals? Or do you have a question about what this proposal does? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Roy Myers of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, formerly part of the Congressional Budget Office. We're looking at President Trump's budget proposal for 2021. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what is in this presidential budget proposal? If the budget were yours to write, where would you invest, spend more? Where would you cut? Would you worry about being cut in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Staying, Roy, with the issues we were just talking about, the Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talking about the budget at a press conference today.
We want to see balance in all of this. We want to see where we can find savings. Let's subject everything we spend to harsh scrutiny so that the results for the American people are the best that they can be. But don't get in front of an audience and say, I'm here to protect Medicare, Social Security, and people, and we say Medicaid too, and then put a budget like this forward.
Right, those changes to Medicaid and Medicare you're talking about, the block grants, some people call them, for Medicaid, the changes in reimbursement rates for providers under Medicare, is that something that people who use those services would feel, either directly or indirectly?
Medicaid, definitely. That would be a huge hit. For Medicare, that's a very difficult question to answer without seeing all the details of what CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, would implement in their regulations. As you know, as a practical matter, we do have to be concerned about the prices we pay to medical providers because they're very, very high compared to the prices that other countries pay. You know, I think there's one thing that Speaker Pelosi left out, though, and that has to do with the administration's participation in a suit that seeks to declare the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. And, of course, if that were to happen, that would be a massive change. If you look at the president's budget, he counts some savings in there for implementing what is called his health reform vision, which I suppose is supposed to be a replacement for the Affordable Care Act if in fact the courts declare it to be unconstitutional. But there's zero details about what that vision would look like.
Let's bring on a caller now. Dion is with us in La Crosse. Dion, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dion?
My question is, I was wondering if the expert could talk about how the tax policies of 2018 and the national debt, the increase in national debt, how that leads to a transfer of wealth based on the interest paid on those debts from the middle class to the wealthy class.
Dion, thanks for the call. Roy, thoughts on the impact of the tax changes in 2018 and the balance of wealth in this country?
Yeah, the law that's popularly known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was actually adopted in 2017, but it clearly has a very disproportionate benefit given to the wealthy. This tax law was very unbalanced compared to previous ones, and of course some previous tax cuts, and particularly in Republican administrations, were focused on the upper strata of payers. So, you know, this is a major addition to the existing inequality in the country. And for that matter, of course, it adds to the deficit. So to the extent to which it eventually produces pressure to reduce the deficit, then the question becomes, are those deficit reductions created by cutting programs that benefit people that are in the middle class or lower class?
Dion, thanks for the call. And there is a concern about safety net programs in the president's budget. What do we see on things that tend to be a safety net, especially for people in the lower income levels?
There's consistent with a rule proposed for food stamps. They would cut back food stamps, and there maybe 3 to 4 million people would lose benefits. That's pretty significant. There's another proposal out there that's, again, highly controversial regarding the so-called public charge rule, which people who are seeking to come into the country or seeking to gain legal permanent resident status or citizenship under this public charge rule would be denied those improvements in their status had they taken advantage of government safety net programs, or if they were trying to get into the country, if they were perceived as possibly being in that position. So that again, is extremely controversial, and there's litigation about it right now.
Let's go back to our callers. Kelly is with us in Cascade. Kelly, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Good program. So you were asking if kind of where we would put our money if we had a say in the budget, and I am a healthcare professional, a climate action coach, and a mother of two children in grade school and middle school, and that tells you probably where I would put my money. But I think if we don't have a strong educational foundation and system, if we don't have a thriving green spaces and a thriving green economy, and we don't have healthy individuals, we really don't have a solid future for our country.
Kelly, thanks for the call. Roy, we've touched on health already. What do we see in the budget in terms of environment and education?
Well, as usual, this administration is seeking to eviscerate the EPA. There's a 27% cut in its budget. Now, Congress has not gone along with those kind of cuts in the last couple of years. But, of course, the reality is that the administration of EPA has made an incredible number of changes to environmental regulations. And so that its budget has been threatened probably is not as meaningful as it otherwise might be, because those regulations are having somewhat of a similar impact on the quality of the environment. On education, there really isn't that much in this budget compared to, say, some previous budgets by previous presidents. There's a very small program for a so-called education freedom voucher, which is a private scholarship program. And there are some cuts proposed in student loan programs. I think if you wanted to take the caller's perspective and broaden it out into a number of the other areas of the budget where we consider that we might possibly make smart investments in our future, a lot of those investments are made in the so-called non-defense discretionary side of the budget. And the cuts over the long term in this budget are really very remarkable. There's something that they call a two-penny plan, which is starting in fiscal year 22, a 2% cut a year in the total amount of money for these non-defense discretionary programs. And that would mean that if you look at that total now of those programs, that's 3.3% of the economy, and it would be halved to 1.6% in just 10 years. I can tell you the Congress is not going along with that. But what it does is it shows that the administration would be making progress on reducing the deficit. So it's quite unrealistic.
Kelly, thanks for that call. Roy, in our last minute or two, a really controversial item in past standoffs with Congress has been over funding for a border wall. What do we see in this new budget there?
Actually, the president has asked for less money than he's asked for the last couple of years. And what's really going on here is actually in the appropriations bill that was agreed to just a couple months ago, Congress basically blinked. The Democrats in the House blinked and said, we're going to appropriate less money for the wall, but we're going to allow you to get away with reprogramming and transferring money like you did in the year before to continue wall construction. And they did that in part because maybe blink was unfair, because it's hard to actually these days control a president who wants to use his powers very aggressively, because members of Congress have a hard time getting a standing in court and able to in order to sue. The other point about the Department of Homeland Security spending is that the president has asked for about twice as much money as we spent last year on dealing with unaccompanied children. And then he's asked for more detention beds and more ICE agents. So as you might expect, that's going to be highly controversial.
Roy, I will watch to see how this is received in the weeks to come. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Roy Myers, professor of political science and public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, formerly with the Congressional Budget Office. He joined us for a look at President Trump's budget proposal for the 2021 fiscal year. As we've heard, that probably won't be the blueprint for a future budget. The House Democrats say they won't go for it, and a key Republican senator on a key budget committee says they won't be holding hearings on it. So it seemed seen as a blueprint for a vision for the president, especially in an important election year. You can join us with your reactions. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keeley Baltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, just in time for Valentine's Day, Keeley and her guests look at the goofy side of love. Meet the authors of the new book, Let's Be Weird Together, Quirkiness in Relationships. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a political expert who says the American two-party system makes the impeachment process almost completely ineffective. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.